Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. I mean, banks. Like we were going to start anywhere else? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the fourth day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So did you ever have one of those days where you say something and then almost as soon as the words are out of your mouth, something happens that kind of torpedoes whatever it was that you said? Well, come back with me now to yesterday afternoon, about this time when we were going over Fed Chair Jay Powell's press conference, and we played you this bit of audio.
I think that the resolution and sale of First Republic kind of draws a line under that period of is an important step toward drawing a line under that period of severe stress.
You know where this is going, right? After an already rough couple of days, shares of Los Angeles-based PacWest started tumbling after hours. The decline continued today. First Horizon, Western Alliance, and assorted other smaller and regional banks most people are not familiar with are having some challenges as well. So, with a line under the period of severe stress clearly not drawn, what, oh, what is a regional bank to do? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab starts us off.
Some of what's happening in banking right now is actually pretty normal. For starters, interest rates are always a part of banking strategy. Those ebbs and flows affect business. And analyst Joseph Wang at Monetary Macro says business is a key word here.
Banks are like any other businesses. Some of them fail.
In fact, banks have failed in 15 of the last 20 years. Most have been regional and small banks, ones that aren't too big to fail. Other normal banking things, borrowing money from other banks or the Federal Reserve, and selling assets. But at a certain point, Wang says this list of everyday bank stuff becomes kind of irrelevant.
Because ultimately, banking is a confidence game.
Confidence is waning among investors. Peter Conti Brown, a professor of financial regulation at Wharton, says banks need to keep that from spreading to depositors.
As banking stress becomes a banking crisis, it's very hard to send the signal so that depositors, investors, and others can separate the sheep from the goats, so to speak.
The sheep are banks that have managed risk well. The goats? Well, the goats have not. Conti Brown says those make up around 5% of the U.S. banking system, which is not a lot, unless they all fail at once.
And so what we're trying to do is strengthen the mediocre and good banks so that they can be in a position to buy up the worst banks.
Industry consolidation. And there's room for it. The U.S. has over 4,000 banks, more than any other nation. These individual deals are supposed to add up to this grand industry-wide confidence in the banking system. Bank A proves stability by buying Bank B. Bank C buys Bank D. You get the picture. But Darius Polia, a finance professor at Rutgers University, says a pattern of saves by lenders and regulators can instead make depositors nervous.
You know, it's like crowd philosophy. You know, when does the crowd suddenly turn?
So this comes down to you. How confident do you feel? I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Let me refer you now, in light of that question from Ms. Schwab, to Wall Street Today, where regional bank shares got clobbered, as you might imagine. Down more broadly, too, on the major indices. Not near as bad, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While we don't yet know what's going to happen with PacWest and some of the other regional banks that are in trouble, we do know that the biggest bank in this economy has gotten bigger with its takeover of First Republic. JP Morgan Chase, of course, is the bank. But we are not going to talk about the company, though. We're going to talk about the guy running it, CEO Jamie Dimon, and the power he now has in this economy. Emily Flitter wrote about that the other day for the New York Times. Emily, it's good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
You point out in this piece that financial historians say that not since J.P. Morgan himself, the actual guy, has a single businessman had such sway over this economy. Frame that for us historically, would you? And then I want to talk about how it came to be.
So basically, it's been 100 years plus since one guy had the power to step in and use his institution to calm things down. There are so many reasons why it's been 100 years since then, and it's not exactly the same. It's not like Jamie Dimon has, dictatorial control over this situation the way John Pierpont Morgan Sr. did, but there are some incredible similarities.
It's worth pointing out here that Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury, when First Republic first started to have problems after SVB and we were looking for sort of the next domino, Secretary Yellen called Jamie Dimon personally. I mean, I think he was her first call.
Right. I mean, think about it this way. You know, you have these giant banks. You have Citigroup, you have Wells Fargo, you have Bank of America, and you have JP Morgan. JP Morgan is the biggest. And look at Wells Fargo. They have had too many problems and they have done too many bad things recently to have authority. Citigroup, too, has had a lot of issues that they're trying to deal with internally. Among other things, they accidentally sent $900 million to the wrong recipient just a few years ago. And JP Morgan has had, you know, some ups and downs, but nothing that makes them look like wrong-footed or like they don't have a handle on their operations like the other banks. And that's has begun to count for something.
It's interesting, you pointed out in this piece, and I had kind of forgotten, that in 2008, Jamie Dimon had only been in that job at JP Morgan for 2 years. And now here he is, kind of the last CEO, the last big bank CEO standing from that financial crisis. I wonder how much of his authority, right, because that's what he has. When the Treasury Secretary calls you, you got some oomph. How much of that is just longevity?
A lot of it's longevity, but, you know, it is hard to hang on to the bank CEO job these days. And that so his longevity counts for something. And you look at Bank of America, Brian Moynihan's been in there for a really long time, but he is post-crisis and Dimon is pre-crisis. And Bank of America had to really pick itself back up, and JP Morgan didn't. I mean, during the crisis, Dimon was very vocal in repeating that that JP Morgan didn't need help and that he was basically forced to take TARP, which was the bailout program that the government put together for all of the banks. Basically, he was forced to take it just to make the other banks look less bad. He never let anybody forget that, and he's been capitalizing on that.
Let me get you back to where we started and that idea that Jamie Dimon is now, for the first time since, 1907 and John Pierpont Morgan himself, he is the business executive with the most amount of power in this economy. Should we be worried?
We have seen an incredible increase in the power that big companies have. You know, I was also curious to know why no other bankers sort of popped up as leaders the way Dimon has over the last 100 years. So I went back and looked, and from the 1930s to the 90s, when we had the savings and loan crisis, we actually didn't have bank runs. So we actually didn't kind of need to have like a public adult in the room from Wall Street. That is sort of part of it. But the other part is the banking industry has benefited from big changes in regulations starting in the 1990s when a new law allowed banks to open branches in other states for the first time. You really saw the industry start to grow from that and consolidate. Then the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was the big separation between investment banking and commercial banking, that created these absolute giants. It really says something like these banks are now really intertwined in the stability of our global economy. Yeah, it is a little scary.
Emily Flitter covers finance at the New York Times, writing most recently about Jamie Dimon and the bank that he runs. Emily, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thank you, Kai.
It's not really any of my business, so don't feel like you have to answer out loud if there's somebody nearby. But how you feeling lately about work, about how much you're getting done? I ask because the Labor Department said this morning that we were all less productive in the first quarter. Technically, it's called non-farm business sector labor productivity, but by whatever name, it fell 2.7% January through March. And that's despite the fact that output, all the stuff that we make in this economy, went up in the same period. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, what really matters here is how the Labor Department defines productivity.
You might think you'd be more productive if you're making more stuff, but what matters here is how much you're producing per hour. Sarah House, senior economist at Wells Fargo, says if you're working more hours,
you could be making more, but it's taking you even longer to make that incremental additional output. And so that means that we're being less productive in that case.
The Labor Department isn't trying to call out your coworker for being lazy or anything. We're talking about the economy as a whole. And overall, more hours are being worked because more people are working, since the economy is still adding a lot of jobs.
Particularly in some industries like leisure and hospitality, it's been really difficult to attract and retain employees. And so in industries like that, you're still seeing some catch-up hiring.
Meanwhile, output, that's the amount of stuff we're making, is not keeping up, says Menzi Chen, an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin.
Production had jumped in the wake of the pandemic. And so what you have is the growth rate of production, which is largely determined by demand, is slowing a lot.
Output is also being held back because there are still plenty of positions that haven't been filled, says Peter Urazim, a labor economist at Iowa State University.
When you don't have enough resources, when you don't have enough inputs, it actually detracts from the productivity of the people who are working.
And that's not a good sign for the economy, says Jason Furman, an economics professor at Harvard.
Productivity is probably the single most important thing in the economy. It's the most important determinant of living standards over time.
Furman says we also want productivity to keep up with wage growth. If wages rise and businesses are more productive, they don't have to raise prices as much because they're making and selling more products.
If instead wages are going up but you have no productivity growth, then businesses are going to want to pass along all of that in the form of inflation.
And that, he says, could make it harder for the economy to avoid a recession. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
It is never easy being a startup in this economy, and it's especially not easy in the EV industry. This week, Lordstown Motors, the electric truck maker based, as it happens, in an old GM plant in Ohio, said it might be in real trouble after one of its key investors said it's going to stop investing. Meanwhile, another electric truck startup, Rivian, that had a flashy IPO just a year and a half ago, has lost 90% of its value. And oh, by the way, the old Detroit heavyweights are making EVs now too. So is there any room in the EV business for startups? What do you think? Marketplace's Henry Epp has that one.
It is really expensive to start a car company from scratch.
It takes time and money to build up the production capacity.
Stephanie Brinley is an associate director at S&P Global Mobility.
It takes time and money to build up the distribution network. It takes time and money and patience to get on consumers' radars.
But money is just not as easy to come by for EV startups as it was a few years ago. Interest rates are higher, and there are recession fears in the air. Plus, it's not always easy to get the parts they need, says Brian Moody, executive editor at AutoTrader.
There's not an established supply chain in some cases for the components, and if there is one, it's expensive.
Rivian, Lordstown, and other startups are also now competing with GM, Ford, Nissan, Toyota, which have all gotten into the EV game. And those legacy car makers entered the EV market with a big advantage, decades or more of experience manufacturing cars, Moody says.
And they have a second advantage, which is that they can use the profits from those already being manufactured automobiles to pay for electric cars.
No such luck if your only products are electric vehicles, which still make up a small fraction of total sales. Smaller startups are also competing with Tesla, which has slashed prices. It dominates the EV market now, but it wasn't always that way.
We have to remember that even Tesla, about a decade ago, was kind of on the edge of collapsing.
Gil Tall, the director of the Electric Vehicle Research Center at UC Davis, says Tesla's success could be hard to replicate, but not impossible. Thanks to government mandates, EVs are poised to grab an ever larger share of the car market, he says.
You have a secure, growing market for the next 20 years. And that's the main reason why EV startups have some chance.
They might just need to have some patience, too, if they can afford it. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Okay, put a scarf on that calf and remember, he's number 707.
707, got it. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, down 286 today, almost 0.9%, finished at 33,127. The NASDAQ gave up 58 points, about 0.5%, 11,966. The S&P 500 down 29.7%, 4,061. Just how bad a day was it for those regional banks that we mentioned on our way into Kristen Schwab's piece? Well, First Horizon dropped more than 33%. PacWest tumbled just over 50%. Western Alliance fell 38%. Zions Bank Corporation lost a relatively modest 12% today. Ball Corporation started out making mason jars. Don't know if you knew that. It's also where Indiana's Ball State University got its name. Now it makes beverage cans and components for air and spacecraft. And it reported that its earnings beat analyst expectations. Shares at an almost 13.4% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The precarious condition of some of the regional banks out there has obliged the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation to come up with a plan to calm the waters. $250,000 per bank per depositor is the current coverage. That's important. The FDIC came out with a report earlier this week with some ideas on how to improve federal backstops that might help bank customers avoid the urge to panic. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the details.
The FDIC report offers three options. Number one, increase the deposit insurance limit from that $250,000. Option two, fully insure all deposits. Or option three, insure business accounts used for payroll and other expenses.
And so to the extent this restores confidence, that could ensure the stability of the financial system.
That's Edward Mills, an analyst at Raymond James, which is a marketplace underwriter. Mills especially likes the idea of insuring those payroll accounts because
if you don't have to worry about the insurance on those deposits, you are more likely to keep those deposits within a bank.
Instead of panicking and joining a bank run, William Isaac also likes the idea of insuring payroll accounts. He headed the FDIC in the 1980s, and he says this option would improve the stability of banks and their communities.
And the people that, you know, the grocery stores and the gas stations and everything that serves those employees need for those employees to have their paychecks.
But the FDIC can't act alone. It needs approval from Congress. And lawmakers are kind of busy right now battling over the debt limit. Henrietta Trace, economic policy director at Veda Partners, thinks the chances of Congress getting to these deposit insurance reforms are pretty slim.
I would say the odds are 10% at this point.
But she says those odds will increase if more banks fail in more congressional districts, especially in the Midwest, where they would affect
farming sectors, the auto industry. Then you start to see material change and a sense of urgency develop.
The FDIC would welcome some urgency. It says uninsured depositors triggered the failures of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
All those atmospheric rivers that brought much needed, but in some cases too much, rain and snow to the West Coast this winter didn't stop here. They moved east, dumping snow and ice across Idaho and Montana, also the Dakotas. For cattle ranchers, that weather has stretched into spring and brought with it a challenging calving season. Newborn calves have been dying because of the cold across much of the West and the Midwest. They're born wet, so they've got to get dry and get some milk and get warm, and they got to do that fast. And that brutal weather has made that tough. The Northwest News Network's Anna King reports.
Have everything for you?
That's it.
In remote southeast Oregon, about the only place to stop for 100 miles is the Oasis Cafe in Gentura. Travelers come in for coffee and to warm up near the wood stove. Locals gather here too. Rancher Glenn Harris sits down with a couple of his neighbors for a hot burger. He's talking about what everyone's talking about right now, how this bitter spring has been devastating for newborn calves.
We had probably 2 feet of snow at least on top of 5 or 6 inches of ice. And those calves are born and they just melt down to that ice.
Usually a cow or heifer gives birth all on her own. Ranchers will find her calf sometimes days later, and that's no problem. But during blizzards, ranchers have to be out every hour looking for fresh calves.
And if you're not right there, you're going to lose them.
The calves can go from about 100 degrees in the womb to 0 or minus 10 with wind. Their wet coats don't help. Harris says this year he's lost around 35 calves and another 25 have froze up joints.
I mean, they can barely walk. It's just been a really tough year.
Harris's eyes glisten. He says he tried to save a young calf recently.
And he really wanted to live, but he just kept getting weaker and weaker. Anyway, it didn't make it, so, yeah.
Each calf can be worth around $1,200 come fall, so losing any is a big deal. Ranchers expect some loss, but this much is rare. In McAlester, Montana, Linda Owens has a cow-calf business and has spent a lot of the winter shoveling snow.
My shovel is very tired, and I'm going to have to get a new one.
Some of her neighbors had to put horses down that slipped on ice. Owen says this cold has been rough.
Digging myself out, my tractor, my pickup, trying to go out and get carcasses off the landscape.
All of these calf deaths are hitting the beef market hard. Nationwide, herd numbers were already down because of drought. Prices are up. Lane Broadbent is with KIS Futures in Oklahoma City.
We just continue to have record high prices, but we've got such extremely tight supplies of cattle available to kill.
And cattle can't be raised to kill just overnight. So that means that beef prices might stay high for years. In Kimball, South Dakota, Colby Olson feeds his cattle. On snow days, his kids pitch in. They help number and match the calves to their mothers.
The kids, they called off school, so I had was picking up calves and throwing them in the back seat of the pickup. And I'd say, okay, put a scarf on that calf and remember, he's number 707.
Olson says he's bringing newborns into the house to dry them with a hairdryer. The only bright spot for ranchers and cattle and all of this, when the snow melts, comes the fresh grass. In Gentura, Oregon, I'm Anna King for Marketplace.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today. You remember Nancy Marshall Genzer's story earlier in the show about the FDIC figuring out ways to make people feel safer that their money is safe in the bank? Well, it does seem the FDIC has some work to do. There is a new survey out from Gallup. 48% of Americans say they are either very or moderately worried about their deposits. To which I say this, remember, it's $250,000 per bank per depositor. Your money is safe. Okay, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It is the FDIC again, but honestly, banks are all that right now. Anyway, Bloomberg reports today that the FDIC is getting set to hit banks with higher fees to refill its insurance fund. That's the fund that pays out when and if a bank goes under. Big banks will pay more, smaller banks much less, actually, or perhaps nothing at all. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.